You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, why don't we go ahead and get started? I suppose that the weather has impeded traffic, and that's slowed our audience down, or the rest of our audience. I certainly hope so. Thank you all for coming. I'm Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies here at Brookings, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to our conference today on Taiwan's maturing democracy. I would also like to thank all our speakers. I think we have an excellent group. I'd particularly like to express a warm welcome to our scholars and others from Taiwan, who I'm sure will make a huge contribution to today's proceedings. Taiwan has a lot of very smart political analysts, and we're lucky to have so many of them here today. I'd also like to thank the staff, who, as usual, have done their outstanding job. And I particularly want to thank our co-sponsor, Stanford University's Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. Larry Diamond, the center's director, has been a friend of mine for many, many years. And more importantly, he's devoted a lot of time and a lot of careful thought to understanding Taiwan's democratization. So it means a lot to Brookings to be able to co-sponsor with him and his center. Now, let me take just a couple of minutes to explain what this conference is not about. And maybe that will help you understand what it is about. It's not about the January 2012 elections. Those contests and their outcomes were really interesting for political junkies and students of Taiwan politics. But we've actually done a conference on that, and so there's no need to do another. If you're interested in that, you can go to the Brookings website. Our conference is not about President Ma Ying-jeou or Dr. Tsai Ing-wen or any other Taiwan political leader. Taiwan has a lot of interesting political figures, but we're not here to psychoanalyze them. Finally, the conference is not about the policies of the Taiwan government, at least not at the outset. You know, we're not going to get into detail about whether it was wise for the current administration to use the 1992 consensus as a basis for cross-strait negotiations or whether a peace accord would be in Taiwan's interest. Rather, our focus is on Taiwan's democratic system itself and the way it structures political outcomes for good or ill. Is that system, in fact, maturing, as we suggest in our title? Is it, to use political science jargon, becoming consolidated? This subject obviously has a lot of academic interests, and we're fortunate, as I say, to have so many good scholars from Taiwan. But the maturity of Taiwan's democracy also has important real-world consequences. The island faces a number of challenges and choices, most notably how to adjust to China, whose power is growing. But there are others. So it's in the fundamental interest of all the people of the island, whether they're greens or blues, rich or poor, or middle class, the old and the young, that these choices are made well. And it's the political system that will really dominate how these choices are made and what the choices are. If the political system doesn't work very well, if it reflects badly the popular will, then it's the people who will suffer. So I think this is an important set of issues that we have before us today. Before we dive in with the first panel, I'd like to invite Larry Diamond to make some opening remarks.
Well, I don't need to be long, since Richard, I think, has very shrewdly and ably framed the conference. I'd just like to say, first of all, that, you know, Richard is one of the people I most admire in this business, and any time I have a chance to invite him to a conference, which I've done repeatedly, and thank you for coming, or to cooperate with him in an analysis or meeting, it's always a pleasure to do so. It's also a great pleasure to welcome many of you here or co-welcome you here, since many of you I've welcomed to Stanford at one point or another, and to say as well that I think this meeting is well-timed and well-crafted, and I can say well-crafted because you were mainly the crafter, Richard, because there is a phenomenon going on in terms of democratic development in the world, and I think we'll see it unfolding over the course of this day. And we were quite struck by it last year at Stanford when the annual meeting that we hold each year on Taiwan, we did last year as a comparative study of two maturing democracies in East Asia, Korea and Taiwan. I have a hunch, I won't get into it in much detail, that much of what we'll hear today, just like much of what we heard about Taiwan last spring, could be said about Korea as well, actually. Certainly it's true in the social and demographic sense, in terms of the remarkable demographic transition that's underway, and in terms of the evolution, for example, of media and society and the obvious things that are going on worldwide in terms of the growth of the Internet and the increasing dominance of alternative media and the increasing independence of civil society. We'll see it as well towards the end of the day in some of the public opinion data that I have to present, where the phenomenon that I think we're seeing in Taiwan of a citizenry that is basically committed to democracy but pretty skeptical about a lot of its politicians and institutions is again reflective of a broader trend in maturing democracies toward what we call critical citizenship. But the maturing of democracy in Taiwan is an amazing development in world history. Looking back from the standpoint of 30 years ago or something, one might say a fairly unlikely one. And we think, many of us, well, I'll speak for myself, I think that it's one that will ultimately have and maybe is beginning to have a very significant influence on the mainland. So this, just because Taiwan now is one of a few liberal democracies in East Asia, I'd say at least three, Korea, Taiwan, and Japan, for that reason alone, it's a significant development. We're studying the maturing of democracy in Taiwan. But given the potential for this first Chinese democracy to possibly inspire the development or in some way help shape culturally and otherwise desire for or thinking about the emergence of a larger Chinese democracy, that's another reason to take this development extremely seriously. So, Richard, thank you again. It's always a pleasure to collaborate with you. And I think now our panel...
Okay. I want to commend both Brookings and Stanford for the way they've put this conference together. I think, as Larry Diamond said, this is a very interesting and important topic and one that gets lost in the specific things that Richard said this conference is not about. And so I very much commend them for putting this panel together. This first panel looks at one aspect of the overall problem, and that is governmental institutions. The executive branch, the legislative yuan, and the judicial branch, three of Taiwan's five branches of government. And I'm going to suggest a couple of perspectives that we can keep in mind as we listen to the presentations. I don't know what my panelists are going to speak about. I know the questions they've been asked to address. But I think one thing is to keep in mind that it's been 25 years since the end of the authoritarian period. How much has Taiwan changed in that period? Second perspective is that they've been asked to focus specifically on the last 10 to 12 years from 2000. So that means that seminal changes in the electoral system that made Taiwan an electoral democracy in the 90s is not really what they're going to be focusing on, or which I hope they will be focusing on, but rather the way the executive, legislative, and judicial branches have worked internally, worked in relation to each other, worked in relation to the society around them. And a third perspective is to remember that while we're talking about institutions, each of these institutions are filled with people. And 25 years ago, these people, civil servants or lawyers, their actions and their attitudes were shaped by the authoritarian period. They now have had 25 years to adjust, changing the patterns of their actions and the way they think about governance in a way that is supposed to fit a modern, maturing democratic society. So I suggest those three perspectives. I think we're extremely fortunate today that we have three very distinguished scholars from Taiwan who arrived last night and leave tomorrow morning. They are really devoted to helping us understand their society. Professor Liao is from the Political Science Department of Sun Yat-sen University in Kaohsiung. Professor Ye is from the College of Law at National Taiwan University. And Professor Li is a practicing attorney, but also an adjunct professor both at Suzhou and NTU. They all have something else, and that is that they all have been involved in the public policy realm, so that they're not just academics. They can bring a breadth of experience to understanding the institutions they've been asked to talk about. And so with that introduction, I'm going to remind our speakers that we would like them to speak for not more than 15 minutes in order to allow ample time at the end for a Q&A, which you all will be involved in. So, Professor Liao?
May I move over there? I'm going to use my PowerPoint.
You certainly may. Can you get...
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the moderator, especially thanks to the conference organizer, Dr. Richard Bush and Dr. Larry Diamond. Really appreciate the organizer's consideration because it's the first time I got the tickets arranged by the conference organizer directly from Kaohsiung to Washington, D.C. It's incredible, right? Because many people think of Taiwan, only think about Taipei, not Kaohsiung. So, yeah, especially I want to thank Dr. Richard Bush. About 12 years ago, right, the year the chairman just mentioned, about 2000, Dr. Richard Bush established American Center in Kaohsiung at our university, National Sun Yat-sen University. Still alive, the center. Okay. And okay, because the chairman already warned us, he's going to be the police, so we have to make our presentation short within the kind of time allocated for us. My assignment is talking about the executive yuan. It's not so easy because it actually usually labeled as a legislative specialist, but now I'm going to talk about the executive yuan. My topic is Cinderella. It's weird, right? In the beginning, I tried to use a title called Little Daughter-in-Law under the premier, under ROC's constitution. But one of my colleagues, he from United States, he said, what do you mean by little daughter-in-law? It make no sense to kind of foreign people because daughter-in-law, maybe in United States, still very strong. But in our culture, little daughter-in-law, 小媳妇, actually try to please the boss, her mother-in-law, very much still right now in Taiwanese society. But the little daughter-in-law make no sense to people here. So some suggest me use Cinderella. Actually, I disagree. Not really like the kind of the metaphor for the premier because Cinderella has a really bright future. He got a prince come to rescue her eventually. But for our premier, under current constitutional system, no way to have anyone to rescue him, only the president. Okay, that's my kind of understanding and interpretation, the role of premier under ROC's constitution. I have to use a full screen adjustment. Where is the full? This minute didn't count in, okay. Yeah. I want to have the slideshow. Where is the? Where is it? The slideshow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The cup here. Okay. Thank you. Then, why I say the premiere similar to a Cinderella earlier age, not later on, they have a happy life with the prince. We have a semi-presidential system, as you know. And actually, exactly 7 times constitutional amendment, we have the dual executive. That's why we call the semi-presidential system. The dual executive power source and duty make it very simple to present to you. The president and premier, you see the power source. The president directly elected by the people, because the, like Richard just mentioned about the election held in January, and then he's going to be the delegate to Taiwan to participate in the ceremony, inauguration ceremony of our president, directly elected by the people. But premier appointed by the president only, without the consensus of the legislative yuan. That power source make their role very different. I have the kind of constitutional amendment rule within to show you the kind of RC constitution accord the premier's power, like Article 53, 55. After the amendment, Article 3, talking about the provisions, Article 55 of the constitution should cease to apply. Article 53 says exactly UN should be the highest administrative organ of the state. And then in the past, the executive yuan, the premier, should get the consent of the legislative yuan, then appointed by the president of ROC. But right now, it's not the case. So it's the power source make them very different. Back. Okay, all the kind of little, will show the evidence, so I won't go into the detail, otherwise I will waste too much time. Our counter-signature. Because in the previous, we had a cabinet system in mind, buried in our constitutional design. So the president announced, promulgate any legislation has to got the countersign from the executive UN's members. But right now it's not that comprehensive. I won't go into the details. Are attached in just like the mirror you can look into, but not here. And also responsibility to the legislative UN. President not really has that kind of responsibility to respond to the legislative year, not such kind of a very clear allocation of the duty. But for the premier, yes, indeed, it's very much so. That's I won't go into the amendment details, just show you. And so the premier's role under this kind of power structure, power source, the president comes from the people, that's democracy. And the premier only comes from the president. He can assign or dismiss him under his will. Okay, so why I say it's similar to Cinderella's role? Because the premier, the only duty he has to do is please the president. Otherwise, he will be dismissed by the president. And superficially, is the chief of the cabinet. He can appoint a cabinet member, but substantially difficult to lead. Why? Because the president is the boss. If the premier want to appoint the cabinet member, on the surface, it is. But substantially, the president kind of willingness, a president preference, always taken into account. Or even though behind the scene, the president tell the premier, maybe in different way, different manner, who he like to appoint to which position. That's so for the chief of the executive yuan, the premier, difficult to lead the cabinet member. A strong cabinet member maybe directly report to the president in a certain way, not so obviously. The premier just cannot say too much because the boss is the president. Then Chen Chong as an example, you can see there's some joke on Taiwan's newspaper. Last month, Premier Chen was tired and sick in L1. He said, okay, I cannot answer your question anymore because he's got stomach ill. Then after the president went to the foreign visit, Then he said, the Ma Ying-jeou, President Ma Ying-jeou said, okay, Chen Chong, I certainly support him even after May 20th. He's still to be the cabinet, the premier. Got a strong support from the president. Then the people make a lot of joke on that. There's a TV program from Taiwan's news media. I think you just take a little look of this. How many minutes do I have? Maybe we skip this because it's only in Chinese. Okay. Okay. You can see that they portray the kind of role of Chen Chong before he ill and a lot of troubles occurred to the current cabinet, like the American beef problem and like the increasing price for gasoline and electricity, that kind of problem. Also, difficult to lead. There's another example recently happened. There's a Taiwan's security exchange incomes. Should we tax on this one or which way we should tax on the security exchange incomes? There's a current financial minister, Liu Yiru. There's a lot of struggle going on. So I don't know whether you know the recent situation. The cabinet meeting cannot solve the problem. And the problem, the kind of the cabinet already put this legislation on agenda, sent to the legislative yuan. Then legislative yuan, the first time in legislative yuan history, to remove this legislation off the agenda. Say, okay, maybe we should postpone. It's never happened in legislative yuan because it's a cabinet bill sent to the legislative yuan. So there's a kind of this historical records. Then the president come forward to say, okay, we still insist on the on taxing on the security exchange incomes and as a legislative yuan to accept this bill and to review this bill next session. Okay, that's the current events. Difficult to lead. I also have a TV program, but I don't think we have enough time to see that. So what consequence we got? I label this as a personalized president. President's personality is crucial to shape the executive function. The president, I use the two, exactly echo back to the chairman's perspective, talking about 2000 from to right now. The president, Chen Shui-bian, and Ma Ying-jeou. I divided their personality into two types. One is a routine breaker, one is a routine follower. One is a good student. The other one is not a bad student, but like to break the routine. So their personality influenced their way to pick up the premier. Routine breaker like Chen Shui-bian, he can either appoint a follower, routine follower, or he can accept a breaker. So there's several ministers during his term, already five. I wish actually six because Zhang Junxiong took the position twice. And routine follower, Ma Ying-jeou, his personality is really follow rules. Very good student, always good student. So he liked to appoint good student too. So that's from Liu Zhaoxuan, Chen Chong, and Wu Dunyi. It's a little bit in between because he's a typical politician. I say that without any bad connotation. Why you laugh that way? But it's in between the breaker. And there's chance for the president appoint the kind of personality of a prime minister. The chance for follower for the routine breakers personalities president like to appoint a routine follower because obedient. But in certain cases, they also can accept a routine breaker. But for routine follower president, they like to appoint a routine follower. So what happened as effect on the executive function? The president dominates certainly under the follower and the routine breaker. But for the breaker, that's a confrontation. Policy making stalemate. That's really strong. I have a lot of evidence for all of this, but I don't think we have time to read through. And for the routine follower to appoint a routine follower's premier, the case is leadership vacuum, especially during the period of crisis occurrence. If we have big crisis, big challenge, contingent situation, it's easy for us to feel, where is the leaders? Where is the leadership? Because people are, in our world, these two kind of people, routine follower, are wen liang gong jian ra. How do we interpret? Just follow the rule. That's a gentle, mild, and always polite to the other part. So it's difficult to make things clear, strong decision. That's a routine follower's personality. Then the last one is difficult to, for the routine follower's president, difficult to appoint a routine breaker. But if really something like Wu Dunyi, he cannot do too much because he's still under the supervision of the president. The president dislikes him, then he lost his job. So he like to show it become a show house, show horse. That's for if the president is a routine follower, appoint a routine breaker, premier, then it's a show horse. That's my categorization. I have all the evidence what they say about their role as a prime minister. So, but I don't think we have time to go through. Very interesting. Every word. I can show you just one, Xie Changting, but in Chinese. See? The Chen Shui-bian blamed Xie Changting, mindless, because you didn't solve the problem. Xie Changting has nothing to say, or maybe the president make the wrong decision, pick up the wrong person. That's what he said before. They have a very strong confrontation. I have a lot of this kind of evidence. Just show you a little bit. Then, okay, a lot, 2 minutes. Prime Minister during the Ma Ying-jeou, they are kind of submissive, but they still feel difficult to play their role because, like, economic issue is supposed to be the prime minister's jurisdiction, but the president had to say a lot about the economic issue, especially regarding the so-called ACFA. Okay, that's how to reform. Then there's one question raised by the Brookings Institution. How we reform the current semi-presidential system? I have to say it's really difficult to reform using a legal formal way to amend the Constitution again because we have a very, very high threshold to pass the kind of the revision, the new revision. I show you the constitution rule. I won't go into the detail. But what we can do, we have a kind of law background, professor and lawyer here, so maybe we can discuss later. What reform should direct to? Parliamentarianism or presidentialism? My view is difficult to go to the parliamentarianism because culture preference to a strong leader. I have evidence here, but I have no time to show that. So then DPP opposed to parliamentarianism, for sure. They occupy, I can show you why. It's interesting. I got so much information here. DPP is difficult to take the majority seat in the legislative union. From the historical records, you can see that's all the DPP, the light green part. So they want, so far, they just maybe totally impossible to accept a parliamentary system. Then the third one is power exchange for coalition, immature yet, even though today's topic is Taiwan's maturing, it's maturing democracy. But for us to have a power sharing, to exchange power, to arrange a coalition government under a parliamentarian system is difficult. We have a failure example, Bian Song meeting in the year of 2005. So I won't show the detail. It's interesting, but sorry, I just have 15 minutes. So presidentialism is easier to evolve. How to do? Currently, a lot of people say the president should deliver the State of Nation report, like American president deliver a State of Union report to Senate and Congress together. Then we can develop that, but there's an argument between whether the president should take question from the LY member or not. I think better not to take question, just follow American's model, presidential model. Then legislation should be better equipped with information power, otherwise they just quarrel a lot. Okay, the third one, the grand justice interpretation of constitution may play a role in renewing the nature of the constitution. We actually depend upon this part very heavily. I think Professor Ye make more explanation about the role of a grand justice in the future. We already did one, that's a 686 interpretation. Everyone should have an investigation power so as to check and balance the executive power. So there's some way for us to incrementally revise our to change the nature of the system. That's my presentation. Thank you. I wait for your further question. I have a lot of information inside there. It's really interesting. Sorry, I just don't have enough time to show you all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Yeh? Professor Yeh will now talk about the legislative yarn.
Thank you. Let me get my. Can somebody help me? Okay, and show. Okay, and now get my. Okay.
Is it yours?
And yeah, slideshow.
Right.
And then from current
beginning.
Slide.
From beginning.
Oh, from beginning. Good. Very good. Thank you very much. Well, first of all, I would like to thank Richard and Larry for having me. I'm very pleased to be here. I would like to share with you some of my observation, to some extent also my experience in the government. But I didn't choose this topic. If I had a chance to choose the topic, I wouldn't choose legislature. I might just choose the executive or the judiciary. Probably judiciary will be on the very top of my choice, and legislature will be the this one, because it's a collective body of constitutional institution, and it's hard to predict, and it has been notorious. What can I say about the legislature? But in fact, it has been getting better. To some extent, it has been getting better, and this is what we are going to talk about. So, how are we going to see through legislature? Under the topic of maturing democracy, what have changed in the legislature or not changed? And also, what were the driving force for this change? And also, what's the impacts of this change? And what's the implications? But we need to know the salient feature of the legislature. So when we are talking about legislative yuan in Taiwan, we simply cannot see this institution from the perspective of, say, Diet in Japan or Congress in the United States. This legislative yuan in our constitution is very different. I put up three elements for you. Number one is it's been operating under five powers scheme. Some of the power enjoyed by a modern Congress may not be there in the legislature. It's enjoyed by, say, control yuan, the other a branch of the government. And it's in the semi-presidential system. You know, the check and balance system and the semi-presidential system is very different. You've got to deal with not only premier, but also the president. And sometimes it's a very fuzzy picture. And also multiple Congress compacts. Taiwan used to have three Congresses, and it's recognized by our constitutional court. Control Yuan, National Assembly, and also legislature, all considered as our Congress. And gradually through constitutional revision and also political change, now legislative yuan emerged as the only one. But still there are complications with control yuan. Only in year 2005, we killed National Assembly. So that legislative yuan emerged, as the only one, so qualified as Congress, okay? So very, very complex. The change or the reform in the legislature has been the core area of the constitutional revision enterprise that happened since 1991. Before 2005, the change has been minimal. The first and second revision was to allow a national, election of the legislature. But it was in 2005, a substantial institutional change happened to the judicial yuan. And that's the topic that we are going to talk about. So when we say change, we are going to say that change happened in 2005, but the first application was in the year of 2008, and then followed by 2012. So what was the change? The change happened in 2005, was a constitutional revision. And I should say I was one of the member of the mission-oriented National Assembly. I was also actually the Secretary General of the National Assembly. I actually signed a document sent in to the President, killed actually the National Assembly. It's on the record. But aside from killing the National Assembly, there was substantial reform. The first one was public referendum for constitutional revision. This is the first part of the enterprise. And we got to put all this package together to understand why there were reforms like that. Why politicians would say yes to that package. Because everybody want to get something from that package. And that's why there was agreement, there was a consensus to push that forward. The other package was in the reform of legislature, comprising three elements. The first one is the most important one, actually, that built up the most driving force for the reform, that is to downsize, to cut into half the seats of the legislative yuan. Before that reform, people just hate the legislature so much. Because at that time, between National Assembly and the legislature, they sort of condemn each other. One called the other a pile of garbage. The other called the other just cockroach. So there was cockroach, the war between cockroach and a pile of garbage. So people fed up with that kind of self-expanding, you know, institutions. And lots of fist fighting, lots of, you know, corruption going on in the legislature. So people gear up and try to punish the legislative yuan. So when the proposal coming out say, let's cut the seats into half, everybody applaud. Every political party followed. And that was the driving force for two very important institutional reform. One is single member district. The other one is two vote system. Sort of putting that proportional representation into the package. So this is the whole package of the 2005 constitutional revision. But these three, downsizing and SMD and two vote system work together. We need to see that as a package. Let me lay out the composition of that. Under the new system, there will be 73 seats open for district election, 6 preserved for indigenous group people, and then 34 by proportional representation. So that was the new system. But while we are talking about the evaluation of this political change, there are two tiers of analysis. Number one is that kind of new system changed to the representation and the legitimacy of the Congress itself, of the legislative yuan itself. The second tier is about what kind of delivery, what kind of performance, what kind of evaluation perceived from the general public. So these are two tiers of performance. I would like to analyze this one by one. Let me begin with the first one. LY before congressional reform, there were lots of party representation, including KMT, DPP, PFP, and also TSU and the new party. So the multi-party representation. After this system, only two. So emerged, so changed into two-party system. But before, it was multi-party representation. And also before, in the previous two terms, the fifth and the sixth terms, DPP was the largest political party in the Congress for two terms. But when it comes to Pan Green and Pan Blue enjoyed the majority. But you see, the percentage is like this. The percentage was 51.4 versus 44.5, 50.7 versus 44.9. The margin was not very big. So that was before the new system. But that political system, that the electoral system, got lots of criticism because, as you see, the per capita representation in Taiwan is about 98,000, and compared to other, you know, democracies, it's really too small, and that's why the people want to cut that. but because it overcut, cut into half, actually creating lots of problems. Now we have 113. So lots of effort has been done, but the single most important deficiencies, in my opinion, is the number. We cut from 225 to 113, cut into half. It should be like anywhere from 168 to 186. That would be the proper number for that. And I have some explanation for that. So the reform, let me skip this and get to the result of the 2008. We are not talking about election. I'm talking about systems, right? But let's see. The Pembroke got the seat share was 67%. And the Penguin, the seat share was 23%. What a difference. That means the majority got more than three-fourths of the seats. What does that mean constitutionally? That means any constitutional mechanism guarantee the minority to propose any bill. That is bigger than one-fourth will become impossible. Let me mention one example. In the past, one-third of the legislature could appeal to constitutional court. One-third. But because of this, this channel of constitutional interpretation has been completely closed. Okay, so this kind of result actually has lots of implication constitutionally. The kind of check and balance mechanism guaranteed by the Constitution actually became obsolete. Because of this result, that is, the majority got more than three-fourths of the seats. But how about the vote share? The vote share doesn't explain in that way. There is disparity. There's very clear disparity going on there. See, KMT, the vote share was 52.4. The seat share was 71. And DPP got 37.5% of the vote, but only got 23% of the seats. So the transformation from vote share to seat share got distorted in such a great extent. Was that because of the electoral rules out of the 2005 constitutional revision, that is downsizing the seats of the parliament from 2025 to 113, and also one single district and two votes? And I argue these electoral rules does matter, and to a great extent cause profound political consequence in the longer term. That's exactly what happened right now. And the situation doesn't get better, only got softened in the recent election, 2012. Okay? So less than one-fourth of the majority in the LY. I have mentioned some of those constitutional consequences. I'm going to skip that. The result of 2012 election, getting better, but still institutional problem, as I just mentioned, that is disparity of the vote share and seat share still there. You see the seat change, an equal vote, okay? So let's see. They look into the issue. The issue is KMT got 53.5 vote but got 71. And let's see some of the extreme representation. In Lianjiang County, that's a little bit less than 10,000 people got one seat. In Xinzhu County, 475,000 people get one seat. You see, about 476 times. So you people got different vote. The weight of the vote are so different. And this is very serious. It happened in 12 seats. Aborigines seats, that was 6, and also offshore islands, and also 2 in the east, Taitung and Hualien. Those are the lowest representation pretty much controlled by KMT. So KMT in any election would get 11 seats anyway. Imagine 11 out of 113. So there is a saying politically that DPP, after this new rule, is not going to be the majority party anymore in history. But some people still remain hopeful that there may be some kind of change. Let me speed up and finish the second part. My observation of the first impact was change to the electoral rules has a great impact to legislative representation. The slight improvement in 2012 election does not prove otherwise, despite that it's an improvement. An issue with long-term significance, but it requires super strong political will to do it and do it right. Okay, let me come to the second tier, and it's going to be a little bit easier for that. Is the legislature doing better after reform? Has the reform contributed to the change for better or for worse? Variables, and also there are variables beyond legislative reform. Let me mention that after 2008 election, four elected legislators from KMT were criminally charged with buying votes during that 2008 campaign and later disqualified as legislator by the court. And this has been, all of those has been final. There could be more to come. But that means 2008, there were buying votes, charges, and actually has been ruled by the court. At least four legislators from KMT has been disqualified. And they all subject to re-election. Most of the seats was regained by DPP after their re-election. So this one. The other one is the satisfactory investigation by, say, TVBS and also by Transparency International and also by, most importantly, Citizen Congress Watch report has been disappointed. But with some sort of improvement, slight improvement. So this is by Citizen Congress Watch. I should say this is the newly established coalition of various citizen groups in Taiwan, and I see this as a very important development in Taiwan's democracy. That is, you have a watchdog group watching the performance of the Congress in a credible way, and legislators actually began to take this seriously. The performance has been relatively better, but not surprisingly well. For example, budget review, the legislation for the history long cut only 0.007% of the budget for that year because the supermajority of the legislature was controlled by KMT. Poor quality of the past acts, that's according to Citizen Congress Watch. And also the Judicial Reform Foundation is one of the very important citizen groups for that, also come up with some sort of a review and pretty much along the same line. And the performance of seven legislators, this is what I have to say. All eight sessions, you see slight improvement, but no significant change being found. Okay? Let me skip this. There are changes, actually. There are streamlined subcommittee into eight, and also less frequent filibuster, and also there is a new institution, transparency mechanism being set up. That is IVOD, that is a live broadcast and video on demand that's available online. But the request for a TV channel that is pretty much similar to C-SPAN has been pretty much dragging their feet. More consolidated watchdog groups, the Citizen Congress Watch, actually has been there, and that's a good sign. Lastly, I would like to say, while observing the performance of the legislative yuan, it's not easy, as I say, but we need to put that into broader picture. Rather than simply take the legislature alone, we need to put it into the context of semi-presidential system, particularly, Professor Liao just mentioned the President National Affairs Report controversy. That just reflects how Congress can react, can do, and that is very limited, actually, to some extent. Sometimes it's not their fault. It's constitutional structure. So we need to look that into a more broader, you know, context in order to understand what's been going on. Thank you very much. I sort of over time was a little bit.
Thank you, Professor Yeh. Like Professor Liao, you've given us a lot to think about, and now we'll turn to Nigel Lee, please.
It's my return to see how this is done. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank for the invitation, and it's a true pleasure and an honor to be here to share with you the topic of judiciary. Were the issue designated as a judiciary alone, perhaps the presentation will be different. But the topic I was assigned to is procuratorate and the judiciary in Taiwan. And that actually allows me to have two issues presented for today's purpose. I would first share with you the major point in my mind. Actually, we're talking about the democracy development in Taiwan. And everybody agrees independence, judicial independence plays extremely important role. So I begin with thinking along that line. First, I must say there is a recent event is taking place, which may play a crucial role in terms of establishing a better system for judicial independence and to enhance the quality of judiciary. Particularly, this event will play a significant role in the future of the judicial reform in Taiwan. That is, we had a new law in place, which is called the Judges Act, Fa Guan Fa. This one was promulgated on July 6, 2011. It will take effect on July 6 this year. So we are still, the law is pending to be enforcement. I'd like to first take a look at the objective of the act. It says this act is to ensure judges can try cases independently. Their tenure should be secured, and the external rating system for judges shall be established. And the act is enacted to protect people's right to a fair trial. This seems to be cliche, but I must tell you, this for the first time, in Taiwan's law, this important role and values has been explicitly adopted. The value of judicial independence was stated explicitly in law, and the very function of the judiciary is to protect people's right to a fair trial. I must tell you, this shared goal by many democracies, now seen in a new law in Taiwan, is not an easy piece. This will be a new and fundamental law for the judiciary in tandem with the Court Act, which was effective since 1932, and which does not actually define the role of a judge. In the Court Act, you know how the judges are appointed, but there is no specific provision stating what is the function of a judge. So I would like to share with you two line of issues from a historical perspective. I would take this as structural issues, not quality issues. If speaking of judicial reform, one major issue would be the quality of the judiciary need to be beefed up. But this is not something I will share with you today. I would say this new act, the act that I just mentioned, is a new, is trying to push for answers against two chronic unsettled issues in Taiwan's legal system. And namely, the first thing is a line between procuratorate and the judiciary has never been clearly drawn in the system. And the second issue is whether procuratorate should be institutionally independent. That's two issues quite crucial in terms of judicial reform. First, I will speak about line between procuratorate and judiciary not clearly drawn. Historically, separation of the judiciary from executive branch is a concept, alien notion in the Chinese culture and political system. So that's why the line between the procuratorate and the judiciary has always been blurred since the inception of the Republic. Before the, in Qing Dynasty, actually the magistrate, local magistrate who also take the judicial power of trial, civil or criminal cases. And since the inception of the Republic, that tradition continues for a while. And since the adoption of the Constitution, the issue, that phenomenon has changed. But the line blurred between the two institutions, the judiciary and the procuratorate, still lingers. I'd like to mention one particular important, in my eyes, this is a very important interpretation, sometimes ignored by many. This the journey of transformation, or to try to draw a distinctive line between the two institutions, I would say began in 1950s. When in 1953, a ruling by the Grand Justices was issued at the request of the Control Yuan. The issue was, what does the judge with a tenure stipulated in Article 81 of the Constitution include the prosecutors? The Constitution sets forth tenure, lifetime tenure for judges. And because the judges are supposed to be independent from other powers, government powers. By the time the law of court says that the prosecutors enjoy the same tenure, similar lifetime tenure as a judge would have. So that's why Control Yuan take the issue to the Grand Justices. And this is the holding. The holding is the judge referred to the Constitution means the judge of the Article 80, 81 and 80 are the same. Means the reason why a judge shall enjoy tenure, lifetime tenure, is because of their function being independent. This is to ensure the independence of a judiciary. That's why it does not include the prosecutor. However, Grand Justice further to stay the status quo at the time, saying, however, guarantee of a tenure for prosecutor extended by the Court Act is the same as that of tenure judges. That's a statement of the then existing law. The reason why I share the issue, interpretation of 1953 with you is because behind this issue of drawing a line between the two actually have a sensitive touch upon the tenure issue, which directly would have impact upon the package, the compensation to be received by the prosecutors. And another crucial judicial decision can be seen in 1960. At that time, the issue was, are the high courts and district courts allowed to be subordinate to the executive branch under the Ministry of Justice in tandem with the procuratorate? At that time, that's in 1960, courts and prosecutors both are subordinate to the Ministry of Justice, Ministry of the Cabinet. And the Grand Justice at that time says, in view of the fact that different levels of courts and subordinate courts below the High Court inclusively hold the judicial power over trials, this court shall be subordinate to the judicial yuan. And this, after the promulgation of this ruling, 20 years later, in the 1980s, the Court Act was amended and this interpretation was implemented. That is, starting at the time of 1980, you see the first attempt to draw a distinctive line between the two. And then in 1995, we have this another new ruling saying that only the judge can enjoy the power to issue writ of habeas corpus, and the prosecutors cannot do that. And this ruling in 1995 is a bold ruling, which actually I will not I have no time to go into details of the this ruling, but I would share that the after the this interpretation, Criminal Procedure Act has been revised nearly 20 times to ensure that the judges are no longer to function further like a prosecutors. They should act as a independent judiciary. And then the adversarial system is being gradually introduced into the criminal procedure to replace the inquisitory system. And this issue is a continuing issue as of the very moment. Another debate is still coming. Recently, the Supreme Court made a decision that the court will not further exercise the investigation to help the prosecutor to prove that the defendant is guilty. The only time the Supreme Court says, the only time the judge of a criminal court will exercise investigation power is to prove that the defendant is innocent. And that invites a serious protest from the prosecutor. One prosecutor claims that he will go to the Supreme Court to sit in front of the Supreme Court door to say that the court has lost its independence. So another round of debate emerges because of this type of issues. And that I consider still the same problem continues. That is, do you see a line to be drawn between the two institutions? One thing about the Judge Act, Chair, tell me that my time is up. But I can share with you the one thing about the Judge Act. There has been a tug of war behind the scene. The original plan of the judiciary is not to include the prosecutor into the judge law, the Judge Act. But the Ministry of Justice disagrees. And after a long time negotiation and the Judge Act, the bill, sits in the legislative yuan for more than 10 years. And eventually a compromise was made. That is, the judiciary will save a blanket chapter for the Ministry of Justice to fill in. And then that chapter was added into to describe the function of the prosecutors. Well, I have to say that probably I should go directly to the to a drawing I tried to delineate for you as a summary of the pictures. Before the enactment of the adoption of the Constitution, the concept of judicial and executive powers are basically a mixture. And then you see the from the executive power, people try to pull out the judicial power. At that time, the only thing in the Constitution was Supreme Court, and then the Grand Justice tried to put the judiciary into an integrated system and try to separate it from the executive power. But at that time, the prosecutors are considered as something in parallel to courts, both under the executive power. And after the implementation of 1986, you see two circles, that is judicial power is separated from executive power, but with the prosecutors sit in between, you cannot tell whether they are judiciary or executive branch. Then after 392, you can tell judicial power try to send the prosecutors back to the executive power, but the prosecutors refuse for that kind of plan. And now the prosecutor try to become independent. I have no time to share with you the details, but is that a good idea? Is something for exploration in the future. I should end my presentation now.
Thank you.
I want to commend Dr. Lee for shedding more light on judicial reform in 15 minutes or so than I have had the pleasure in the past to receive. Before I open the thing for questions, there is one aspect of the operation of the legislative yuan which I think needs to be put on the table as an issue in terms of democracy, and that is that, as I understand it, the majority of bills that pass through the legislative yuan are, in fact, dealt with and finalized through a process of inter-party collaboration or consultation. And they are not voted on in committee and in the plenary. And as this is a very unique part of Taiwan's judicial system, I wonder if I could ask Professor Ye to explain how this came about and whether it is a good thing and whether it needs reform.
Well, thank you very much for this. I actually put the issue in my PowerPoint, but I didn't got a chance to explain that to you.
I cut you off, so I'm giving you the chance.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, it's a very unique operation. In practice, any recognizable party, major party in representing in the legislative yuan form a caucus, and of course during the before the second reading, before sending a bill for second reading. you need to, in practice, you need to get a signature from the leader of every caucus. Okay, I have the experience of asking for signature from various. But the problem is, how about those group of people? They are only like 3 or 4 or 5 legislators. They claim they don't belong to any political party. But nevertheless, they form as a group. And they say, we are going to form a caucus. And that was exactly what was going on. They tried to gain as much as possible from the process. And it got recognized. The internal rule of the legislative yuan recognized if you have more than 3 legislators forming together, then you can form a caucus. And for any bill who is going to send for second reading, you need to get their signature. And you see lots of sort of bargaining going on. The small group of people would like to ask for lots of returns for their signature. And I personally took pains in asking for that when I was in the government. And I think this is one of the unique practice in our legislative yuan, but need to be addressed. This is really the bad practice, in my opinion. Yeah.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to open it up for questions. And following the general rules here, ask you to identify yourself, to keep your comment or question brief, and to wait for a microphone. So who would like to go first? Up here in front.
Thanks. I'm Mike Fonte. I'm the DPP's Washington liaison. I wonder about the legislative yuan process. I noticed recently Legislative Speaker Wang Jinping had to break a tie, and then there was also a committee where there was a 7-6 vote. Not all the KMT people voted. So I guess the question is whether the reforms, the single-member district and the accountability that comes with it is having that kind of an impact now. It used to be caucuses would always vote whatever the party said you had to do it, right? Now it looks like, at least in the current situation, there seems to be some flexibility, shall we say, on the KMT side. Wonder what your thoughts are.
Well, I would say the recent American beef issue, you actually see a swing vote. I don't know whether it's swing vote or not. It's a critical vote by the speaker, by Wang Jinping. But that was very exceptional. That was because party discipline on this issue simply cannot control, I mean, each individual legislators for this particular issue. Otherwise, on other issues, I still see very strong party hold on all issues. There is a figure going on. It has been investigated by the Citizen Congress Watch. Majority of the bill was like 90% support from one party or 90% support from the other party, very divided. For each individual legislator to deliberate and also some sort of very rational debate, in my opinion, has not been there. And particularly that kind of system, as I mentioned, you know, you still have that caucus party discipline and for individual party to endorse any kind of policy. So that kind of democratic deliberation, I think the level of that is still low, in my opinion.
May I also respond a little bit? Because under the single-member district, actually each legislator got pressure from the constituency more than from the party. If the legislator receive a lot of phone calls from the constituencies, then they will avoid the party discipline, try to defect. That's the current situation. Also the same case in the United States because a single-member district. I predict the party discipline will be looser in the future because of constituency pressure getting heavier. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I'll have Garrett, and then we'll go to the back, and then up to Alan.
Thank you. My name is Garrett Van Der Wees. I'm editor of Taiwan Communique. I have a question about the judiciary for Nigel Lee, but Professor Ye also wanted to talk about the judiciary, so I'm also giving you a chance, I think. Professor Jerry Cohen at Harvard a couple of years ago wrote an article, and he criticized the judicial profession in Taiwan for not standing up more for judicial reform in Taiwan. He called it very politicized, and he said there should be more of an effort by the profession itself to move towards judicial reform. And he actually referred to a nation of sheep. What would you do if you would have your druthers in terms of moving towards judicial reform in the future so it really becomes a very neutral and truly independent system?
In short, I think the very issue I presented today, that is to draw a line between the judges and prosecutors, exactly is should be the focus of the judicial reform. That is helpful to shape the value of the judicial independence, something in lack of since the beginning of the things. And we are still in that process, and we have a new law. And I think we are at the wake of judicial conscience of the value of the judicial independence. Of course, relevant issues is the quality and the accountability of judges. That is, I think, a more serious problem because we have already bureaucratic or we should say institutional or career judges. Most of judges start to serve as judges since they're perhaps majority of them since the time they graduate from law school after they pass the judges test. That has been a issue for constant discussion or debates. As to one of the plan of the judiciary is to stop using a judge test to select judges. Instead, they like to appoint judges more like American system to appoint new judges out of senior lawyers or prosecutors or professors. But that effort has not been proven successful. So people are still trying to figure out how to enhance the accountability of judges in terms of the quality. But that may really take a generation to overcome. On the other hand, I would say another important value of the Judge Act, sometimes ignored by many people, is that this Judge Act, in one of the provisions, for the first time again, explicitly state the judge has a mandate to try their cases in accordance with the constitutional power, and they should apply constitution as a part of the basis for their judgment. And this seems to be a common sense, but again, this is the very first time that provision has been introduced. And with that provision in place, the judges would have a mandate and, of course, and a duty to write into their judgments notions compliant with constitutional values. I take that extremely important, and that's why one of the reasons I would take this Judge Act as a crucial factor in terms of judicial reform in the years to come.
Thank you. There's a gentleman in the far back of the room.
John Xie from the University of South Carolina. I have one question for Professor Liao, another one for Professor Ye. And in Professor Liao's presentation, at the end of the presentation, she talked about two options for Taiwan's constitutional future. One is for parliamentary system, another one for presidential. I'm just wondering why not just stick to the semi-presidential system, whether it's possible that just with some kind of minor revision that this system can still be a kind of viable option. For instance, if you believe that divided government situation is bad, and then why not just give the legislative yuan some kind of investiture vote, that is, when the president nominates the premier, and the premier has to be, then the legislature has to have a vote to express its consent with regard to the presidential nominee and so on, and whether you think that that's also viable. And another question for Professor Ye, this is really out of curiosity, because you mentioned that this new system, some people call mixed member majoritarian system, MMM system, and benefits give huge bonuses to the large parties, particularly the largest party. And we all knew that, and even before 2004 constitutional reform, actually some people in the DPP, like Lin Zuo-Xue, for instance, were opposed to the kind of a revision. And but then the DPP actually just went ahead. And I don't know whether you have any kind of inside information about why the DPP want to kill itself, to commit suicide.
Okay, thank you for Professor Zhang Xie's question. Actually, if you pay attention enough, I didn't say we are going to change the current semi-presidential system. I already said the reform is difficult, especially through the kind of formal amendment procedure, because we set up a 3/4 first in the legislative union. Then it's a half of the general electorate. That's 9 million votes. It's really difficult to get a new amendment. So I said the incremental way. The incremental, including the kind of political consensus, including what you mentioned about is if it is possible to have a certain kind of consensus from the legislative year after the president appoints the prime minister. Actually, French system does have this kind of procedure. If the cabinet minister, if the majority seat in the legislative yuan is not ruling the president's party, then the prime minister, even appointed by the president, he still can ask for a consent from the parliament. That's a French system. We don't have that rule, but we may be able to create that rule within the legislative yuan's internal law. It's possible, but depend upon power struggle. I don't think at this moment it's possible, because each ruling party, the president, I think everyone doesn't want to have a rule to constrain its power. That's the current situation. But in the future, maybe two parts. The ruling president is another party. The parliament belongs to the majority seat in the parliament is another party that's divided, so-called left and right cohabitation in French system. It's possible to happen that way, but still depend upon power struggle. So I think that we still can, under the current semi-presidential system, we won't have a big change, but slowly, incrementally, it's possible to have fix a certain kind of a current, not really working very well situation. Yeah, thank you for your question.
I don't have inside story, but I do have some personal recollection. some of the development during that period of time. We need to remember at that time, before the election, before a major election, major political parties all agree about this proposal, about a whole package, including small parties. There was, they all agree before the election. Of course, a group of people solicitate the kind of package. And they all say, yes, we endorse that. And the problem is whether you are going to honor that after that election. So every party, political party, has its own calculation. When it comes closer to the actual substantiated package of the law, they began to defect. Some began to defect. So there were negotiation going on. The incentive for DPP, as I understand, to come in terms with other political parties on this matter was because it's the package. DPP liked that referendum so much. As I say, it's a package. It's not only congressional reform. It's a referendum for any constitutional revision. DPP has been pushing forward for direct citizen involvement in major political issues, including the revision of a constitution, for such a long time. And that was a hope that all political parties agree. Right? So that's one. Second one is DPP at that time has been very optimistic about their performance. At that time they were the biggest political party. I mean they think that their goal toward, you know, or crossing that majority line is not impossible. I mean, at that time, is you know, you see that mentality of that. They know that it is going to put them in disadvantaged position. They knew that. But they were saying that we are progressive party and we want to move forward. We are in disadvantaged position, but we want to resort that to the constituency by say, help us. You know, we are doing reform and why don't you kind of help us out. And we are so close to that. That's second. That's second. And I think the package itself can explain why every political party finds some way to agree upon those deal. And things turn out to be very different. And I need to mention the role of Lin Yisheng. Lin Yisheng actually, Mr. Lin has been very respected, and even President Chen Shui-bian actually has been very, very sort of respect him. And he insists so much. And the last point of this is about that downsizing. I think the biggest problem lies in the downsizing, not in that two votes or in that single district. Because when you downsize from 225 to 113, every seat means a lot, And you allocate that seat to others, you find that the disparity is even more severe in reflecting to that 11 seats, guaranteed 11 seats. You spell out a problem like that.
Thank you. Can I add a little bit episode regarding the kind, okay, both, because Professor Ye mentioned about each party find a certain kind of position in the package of the constitutional amendment. Actually, each party, only two, that's KMT and DPP. KMT at that time want to kick out the people-friendly party, PFP, and also new party, because under the previous system, KMT compete with these two parties. And DPP want to kick out TSU, Taiwan Solidarity Union, because a small party compete with the same constituency. Then they kick them out. The small party altogether cannot influence anything at that time.
Thank you. Alan Romberg, Stimson Center. Thank you all for your presentations. Really interesting stuff. I have a question for Professor Li and also one for Professor Liao. For Professor Li, you talk about the relationship between executive power and the procuracy, but executive power is divided between the president and the prime minister. And there have been accusations both during the China administration and during the Ma administration, that the president has involved himself in ensuring that there are prosecutions against opposition politicians. And President Ma has said, no, haven't done that. I'm not involved in this. And I think in the China administration, you get the same denial of presidential involvement. And yet there's a feeling that on the part of those being prosecuted that, in fact, that is what's happening and or has happened. And I wondered if you would comment on that. And second, for Professor Liao, I'm not sure how to apply the concept of leadership to your breakdown between follower and breaker. Is it impossible to have strong leadership in this system? Is a breaker somebody? I don't quite understand the concept of breaker, frankly. My sense is that one of the issues in the Ma administration has been leadership and whether there is strong enough leadership to overcome some of the obstacles that the administration has encountered. And I wondered if I could draw you out a little bit on that.
Yeah. You raised a question about a part that I didn't have chance to present. This relates to the prosecutor general. This is a position similar to the United States Solicitor General. It's the leader of the team of the prosecutors. In the year of 2006, the legislature passed changed the Court Act to make the appointment process of the prosecutor general into one that being appointed by the president with the advice, with a confirmation vote by the legislature. That really takes the prosecutor general away from the Ministry of Justice supervision. That makes, and in the same law, that the new amendment, the legislature established something we call a 特征组, a special investigation group, and empower under the direct supervision of the prosecutor general with a mandate to make investigation of crimes by high-ranking officials, that including up to president. And that law says, the president appoint prosecutor with the consent of the Congress. So the president is himself supposedly cannot would not be able to direct the prosecutor. And the prosecutor general has a term of 3 years. And actually, it was the very prosecutor, the first prosecutor general appointed under the new regime of law by President Chen Shui-bian, who later prosecuted Chen Shui-bian, President Chen Shui-bian. And of course now this is there is another existing prosecutor general. What's the real function of these special investigation? People have a different feeling about this the function, and that links to the issue of whether the prosecutor should become an independent institution. Some notion try to push for a similar notion of a special or independent prosecutor in the United States. We know the American experience along that line for some years, and that was not adopted anymore. But that the concept that the prosecutor can be another branch or similar function of judges help the prosecutor try to present themselves to be independent from the daily executive powers. So, well, you see a host of issues for debate along that line. So that's why I put eventually a circle with a question mark whether the prosecutors can be separated from the executive power.
Okay. Thank you for Alan's question. I think maybe putting it the other way maybe make you easier to understand, like the, in the Western way, American textbook like to categorize different personality. One is bureaucrats, the other is a politician. Bureaucrats means they follow rules all the time. And if they see anything not within their jurisdiction, they just see all kind of patternized way of doing things. But politician, they basically rule creator, not follower, because they come into the legislative union or like here Congress, they know how the legislation passed by then. So the different mentality. In Taiwan, I think I use the routine breaker and routine follower because not everything put into the words, not black and white, but some routine, some patterns. In Taiwan, currently the president, you can see the Chen Shui-bian. He can do something unpredictably because he think, okay, if the rule didn't say it clearly, not by white and black in words, then he can do whatever he wants. But Ma Ying-jeou will follow even no words, and he still follow previous patterns. Some implicit, we call the certain shallow institutions, not by words. Yeah, so that's a kind of big difference. And in Taiwan, because Chen Shui-bian act too much, then people choose another one because it's a big contrast. I think it's either for good or for bad. But for the in the situation of crisis, we really need someone he or she dare to break the previous pattern, like the typhoon happened in Taiwan quite often during the summer. And who should come the first? Come forward to order the military people to rescue people in the villages. It's not so clear. It's the prime minister. Prime minister think okay. The highest commander of the military people is the president. So depend upon under that situation really depend upon leadership. You think about situation. You got information. You make decision. You move forward. Break the kind of unclear rules. That's a problem in Taiwan right now. Both personality so far are really good person, but not really that politician oriented. That's my opinion.
Okay, thank you very much. This has been a very rich discussion. I have a question I'd like to ask, but our time has run out. So I'd like to ask all of you here to join me in thanking our panelists for an excellent presentation. Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's excellent. Yep.
So we'll take a break, and we will resume about 11:05. Gentlemen, may I ask you to take your seats? I think we'll get started. I think this panel should be as interesting as the last.
Okay, let's get started. The previous panel, we talked about the institutional arrangement in Taiwan, and now we move on to the behavioral side of the story, and meaning that we will look at how people behave, how they interact with each other, and so on. And so we are talking about all different kind of players, of course, in the political game. And, of course, the two topics are related in some way. And behaviors in a democracy is to some degree conditioned by the political institutions and so on. And for instance, the previous panel we talked about the the electoral reform in Taiwan, the rule has been changed to from the old so-called single non-transferable system to the new, it's also called, it's called the mixed member majoritarian system, and similar to the kind of system used in Japan and so on. So that's a since that's an effect, the number of political parties, the number the political fortune of the political parties, and how people, the actually the politicians involved, how they are going to face their constituencies and how the constituents and how they are going to interact among themselves and so on. So all these systems are related. But of course, the in terms of the behavior side, and there are a lot of other factors which will in affect players' behavior too. And in addition to institution, there are many other cultural, social, economic, and so on. And just one example, for instance, for anyone who knows anything about Taiwan, and you could not fail to notice the importance of the national identity issue, for instance, people supporting independence or unification or state school and so on. And this kind of cleavage will very much affect politicians and even the voters and so on in Taiwan's politics. And we have three distinct speakers and on this panel to talk about the various aspects of Taiwan's politics and the society. And on my right is Professor Shelley Rieger from Davidson College, and she's very well known in Taiwan politics in general and political parties, particularly the Democratic Progressive Party in particular. And she's going to talk about party or something on this panel. And then another speaker, Mr. Eric Shi. He's really the kind of celebrity in Taiwan, and he's a TV anchorman and very well known. I think he used to work for the TVBS, now working for CRI TV, 中天新闻, I believe, right? And I suppose that he's probably will talk about media and politics and so on. And then we also have Eric Yu from the from National Zhengzi University. He's associated with the Election Studies Center of National Zhengzi University. Also teach the political science department there. And he's also kind of a very unique background because his field is not only about Taiwan. Actually, he studied the state politics in the United States. And so a very unique mixture of the specialties. And now we start with Shelley Rieger for 15 minutes.
Okay, well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, as always. And I will, I guess, stay here in my chair because I don't have any PowerPoint to show you. Sorry about that. Which is probably a really bad thing today because my mind is so racing after listening to the wonderful presentations this morning that it's maybe difficult for me to maintain a coherent, straightforward train of thought without having the discipline of the PowerPoint, but I'll do my best. So the place where I want to begin today is just by saying you do not want to be a Taiwanese politician at this moment. It is an unbelievably Larry mentioned earlier today the idea of the critical citizen or the critical citizenry. Well, Taiwan doesn't have a critical citizenry. It has a cranky citizenry, a crabby citizenry. President Ma Ying-jeou was just reelected in January with a healthy share of the vote. His popularity and approval ratings are now down in like the teens. So even a person who can win an election cannot be liked or loved by anyone. And then you have President Ma's opponent who couldn't even win the election. So, you know, you really don't want to be a politician in Taiwan today. No one is popular. And maybe, Eric, you can tell us later if you would say the same thing about American politics, actually, that no one's popular here. I think this may also be true to some extent. So this critical citizenry may be a global phenomenon, but it's certainly a phenomenon that is on full display in Taiwan. And one of the consequences of this kind of general unpopularity of politicians of all kinds is that it creates some mysteries for us to wonder about and kind of unravel in Taiwan politics. For example, in the first panel, Professor Ye was talking about the worrisome phenomenon of supermajorities in the legislature under the new system, and the fact that at one point the KMT and its allied parties had over three-quarters of the legislature, which actually gave them kind of carte blanche to do all kinds of things, including perhaps some of the very valuable and useful constitutional amendments that were suggested by the first panel, but they did not. They not only didn't use their three-quarters majority to amend the Constitution, they actually failed to pass a surprising portion of President Ma's legislative agenda. And I agree with my good friend Dachi Liao that party discipline is getting weaker, and I think ideological coherence in political parties is also getting weaker. So I think the very passion of the panelists and the enthusiasm of the panelists in the first panel really underscores the degree to which Taiwan's democracy is still in the process of maturing. And it's very much a work in progress. And the pieces don't fit together right yet. All of that is also true for political parties. And so where I want to kind of direct our attention today for discussion later, I hope, is toward two big factors that I think help to explain why this kind of feeling of unsettledness and upheaval and the inability of political actors to kind of drop into slots that are meaningful and desirable to the electorate in a kind of enduring way. I think there are two big factors driving that. One is just a general problem of new democracies, the challenge of continuing to evolve the party system after the initial rounds of elections so that it continues to reflect the preferences which are also evolving in the electorate. And I think, obviously, again, American politics illustrates this well, it's always hard in a democracy for political parties to keep up with new issues, to know how to situate themselves relative to changing events and changing preferences in the electorate. But I think there are particular aspects of this that are especially relevant to new democracies. And then I think for Taiwan, in addition to the more general problem of party evolution in new democracies, is the specific problem of cross-strait relations as a kind of cloud hanging over Taiwan politics at all times, and a cloud that people have in various ways, in at various moments, tried to kind of blow away or get out from under. But this cloud follows Taiwan people wherever they go. And the major consequences of the cross-strait issue hanging over Taiwan politics are pressure and uncertainty. So just to say a few words briefly about the general problem of political parties in new democracies. This really came home to me at another conference that Larry Diamond sponsored last year, the one he mentioned before, on comparing political development and democratic consolidation in Taiwan and Korea. And then also this semester, I've been teaching a course, which is a comparative politics course, comparing Japan, Taiwan, and Korea. And I've really begun to see a lot of similarity in the frustration of party leaders in Korea and Taiwan and the frustration of voters in South Korea and Taiwan with the difficulty of kind of getting parties to align with the meaningful preferences and the actual issues that are driving politics now, you know, 15 to 20 years after the democratic transition. And I think part of the reason for this is that the original agenda on which political parties in Taiwan, as in South Korea, were formed, the initial cleavage was over political change. Do you want democratization or not? So the DPP was born as a party advocating for democratization, political change. And the KMT, during the early years of the democratization process, was the party that was skeptical about political change. Taiwan also had another item on the agenda. The DPP was asking for political change, democratization, the implementation of the ROC constitution, and so on. But the DPP was also asking for ethnic justice. From the beginning, the DPP had the demand that the so-called native Taiwanese, right, Bunshengren, should be treated as full citizens within the Republic of China. The democratization issue was actually, the DPP basically won that fight very early on. The KMT acceded to the DPP's demands for political change, institutional change. So, you know, the DPP got what it wanted. And that left, as John has just pointed out, national identity, which is kind of where the ethnic justice issue grew into, or what the ethnic justice issue grew into, left national identity as the major point of differentiation between the DPP and the KMT. This had a couple of problematic effects going forward for political parties. One is that the original agenda of democratization and ethnic justice created alliances across other kinds of issue areas that have made it very hard for the DPP and actually for the KMT also to develop new positions on new sets of issues. So essentially, Taiwan politics is still very lacking in a left-right distinction. When the DPP tries to, as it has done in the past, be a kind of social democratic center-left party, it unsettles its own base because its base includes lots of capitalists who wanted democratization, who wanted ethnic justice, who had a particular identity that aligned them with the DPP, but they're not crazy about, you know, like tax reform. That doesn't seem like such a good idea to them. Similarly, the KMT is also facing, as it tries to raise some new economic items on its agenda, and we saw that this morning too, I think, in Professor Ye's presentation, getting pushback from within the KMT, because the KMT too represents a range of interests across the economic spectrum that make it hard for the KMT to push a particular kind of economic agenda. So on economic issues, the parties are kind of paralyzed in how far they can go because the original basis of on which they were constructed was not economic, but fundamentally political. So as the salience and usefulness of democratization disappeared because Taiwan became a democracy, the DPP fell back more and more on national identity. And the argument I would make is that national identity is also becoming more and more problematic for both political parties, perhaps because, one might argue, the DPP has also, in some kind of fundamental sense, won this issue too. But like the issue of democratization, seeing the wind shifting in the DPP's direction, the KMT has moved along with it. And the KMT, too, becomes a party that can manifest the right kinds of positions much of the time on the national identity issue. I also think that for the first 10 to 15 years of Taiwan's democratic development, After 10 years, after 1987, when Taiwanese began going to the mainland, there were kind of two ways of thinking about national identity. One was, you know, do you sort of identify yourself as a Chinese, maybe thinking that unification someday might be something that would make sense for Taiwan, or do you identify yourself as a Taiwanese and really don't look at independence as something of interest to you, or sorry, don't look at unification as something of interest to you. And then there's the engagement, right? How do you feel about engaging mainland China economically and socially in terms of people going back and forth, money going back and forth, activity going back and forth, versus a kind of skepticism about China, which says, you know, I want to keep that stuff to a minimum because it makes me nervous to think about Taiwan becoming too deeply involved with China. So for a long time, that sort of Chinese identity and that willingness at least to think about, in theory, the possibility someday in the future of talking about unification and pro-engagement, these things kind of aligned. And an unwillingness to consider unification as a possible for future for Taiwan and that kind of Sino-skepticism also aligned. I think what we see increasingly, especially with young Taiwanese, is that a strong Taiwanese identity is accompanying a pro-engagement attitude toward the mainland. And that is a problem for both political parties because it makes it hard for the KMT to talk about unification, which is something that the KMT leaders sometimes think they need to do in order to be consistent in their own approach to their conversations with the PRC, but also with Taiwanese people. And it's also problematic for the DPP because the DPP is then torn between its fundamental Sino-skepticism of its traditional base and the need to appeal to a class of voters who are very Taiwanese in their identity, but also pro-engagement in terms of the concrete policy preferences that they have for Taiwan in the future. So I think what we have is we have political parties that are kind of out of sync with the complex of preferences that they're facing in the electorate. And it's not just ideological, it's also genuinely policy-oriented. You know, even if I agree with you ideologically, we don't necessarily share a view of how to get to our shared goal. Because, and this is my very last point, bottom line is Taiwan is in an incredibly tight spot that is getting tighter all the time. Figuring out how to deliver the preferences of Taiwanese people, which are preferences for continued economic prosperity, good relations, that is to say non-conflictual relations with the PRC, without conceding much, if anything, in terms of Taiwan's sovereignty and autonomy, it is a very tall order. So I guess I would just conclude by saying it's no wonder people don't like politicians.
Thank you. Now let's turn to Eric Shi, media. So.
Sure. Excuse me. I don't have PowerPoint with me today. Actually, I do not, but I just prefer standing while speaking. And first of all, of course, I would like to thank Richard and Professor Diamond for first inviting me to this conference. And this is like a homecoming for me because it's been almost 4 years since I left Washington, D.C. And but it feels just like yesterday. And I was given a task of examining the functions of Taiwan's media. And I'm going to approach this issue by answering six questions. And the first question is, how have the news media evolved over the past 20 years? And I'll give you a quick summary. First of all, the 1980s and the 1990s. There's a lifting of martial law in the second half of the 1980s, which led to the explosion in terms of numbers of printed media. We have so many newspapers, we have so many magazines, and that existed in a very, very competitive environment. And then early to mid-1990s, we have the deregulation of the cable news media. And for people who lived through that time, it was generally referred to as 第四台, the fourth network. And, of course, in addition to the three major networks, Taiwan Television, China Television, and Chinese Television. And then, fast forward to the 21st century, we see a relative downfall of the printed media in terms of their ability to generate revenue. And there are a number of reasons. First of all, the economic performance in Taiwan was poor. It's as simple as that in the 21st century. And second of all, the advertising revenue for Taiwan as a market has sort of went down and stagnated. And the yearly advertising market for communications industry in general is about $2 billion, or 60 billion NT, and which is about the case for about 10 years. And third of all, the advertising budget shifted from printed media to cable news operators or cable content providers. So it is harder and harder for newspapers to make money. And in the past, before 1990 or before the 21st century, it was essentially a cash cow business. You print newspapers and you make money. But it was no longer the case. And lastly, the cable news stations have become the primary source of news providers. And basically, it is a unique Taiwan phenomenon, I would argue, and we'll talk about that later. And so, first of all, we see the relative downfall of the printed media, but also we have to pay attention to a newcomer, and which is an exception to the rule, and which is a success story. And that is the next media group we're talking about, Yi Chuanmei Jitian. And it includes Apple Daily and the next weekly tabloid magazine. And the formula of their success is they're totally consumer-oriented, basically give what the readers want to read. And it includes, of course, among other things, celebrity scandals and government corruption and extramarital affairs of leading standing members of the society. And it's more like the New York Post page six on steroids. And it is basically what we have, and which is the exception to the rule when the newspaper business and the magazine business is going downturn. We have this newcomer with a different perception of how to run the business and how to perceive what news really is and directly push it to the deliver them to the consumers. And this is the first question that I try to answer, the development of the news media in the past 20 years. And how do the media interact with the political system? I think it is, of course, no secret that basically in Taiwan, all media takes a political position. And for example, we have news media that's whose position is already pretty entrenched or dug in. It's like the United Daily News, the China Times, and the China Television, Zhongshi, and Formosa Television, Mingshi. And the position is well known. Either you're pan blue or you're pan green. And there are also operators whose position is subject to the transition of power, of political power. For example, TDB, Taishi. It really depends on if the blue is in power, then it is mainly a blue station. If the DPP is in power, then it's basically a green station. And also, which is also more or less the same for CTS, Chinese Television System, Huashi, and until recently. And also, in terms of political leaning of news media, we also have a cable news operators, cable news stations. Basically, cable news operators, they're searching for a niche market as a function of advancement in technology. Because when there are only three major networks, it's easy to understand that the chief of the newsrooms are trying to focus and try to grab the biggest share of the pie. But now with the advent and advancement of technology, and especially cable news, and you have 100 stations and channels to choose from, and you have 6, 8, 7 news channels that's airing news all day long, 24/7, then it is inevitable that you're no longer pursuing the biggest part of the pie. You're pursuing a niche market. And a niche market, if I break it down, long story short, there are blue stations and there are green stations. And blue stations, for example, the ERA, 年代电视, or Eastern Broadcasting Corporation, 东森, and CTI Television, 中天, and TVBS 电视台, they're considered pro-blue. And the pro-green stations are the Formosa Television, 明视, and SET Television, that is 三立. And it is kind of interesting that for cable news stations, the political standings is sometimes is really a function of market force, and you want to cater to the audience that you're going after. And probably 10 years ago, the blue-green split is about 60-40, and now probably 55-45. And so you have a relative number of blue stations. You have maybe 4 blue stations and 2 green stations. And 4 blue stations will fight for 60% of the market. And the 2 green stations will fight for the 40% of the market share. And but we also have a exception to the rule, a media that does not have any political leanings, or to hell with it, that is the Next Media Group. And the Next Media Group, it is suffice to say that the for their the way they operate, their success, the modus vivendi is by being non-political and catering to the consumers, and therefore it is not as intellectually intensive as other newspapers. And this is what we have by looking at how do they interact with the political system. And you have blue, you have green, you have to hell with it. And and for a variety of reasons, deeply entrenched, or given the political who is in power. And of course, then it's a function of market force and search for your niche market. And have the media improved in professionalism? The third question, independence and impact. First of all, professionalism. Well, the professionalism of the media, people who work in the media, professionalism is either stagnation or lower. The reason is very, very simple, and which I'll talk about later. And it has a lot to do with the number of people who's working for the news industry. And the number has remained relatively stable if not increasing a little bit. And that means although a very competitive market, it does not weed away the weak links or one of lesser qualities. And also, inevitably, in terms of professionalism, people who in the industry, their worldviews are not one of their strong suits. And in terms of understanding the United States or understanding the world, understanding the EU, probably not. And in terms of not many of the people who works in the industry have enough exposure of a foreign environment or a foreign media environment, and that is the constraint given by the what we see nowadays. And in terms of independence, well, it's fair to say that there's less or non-government control, especially in the printed media. And for the broadcasting media, that is a little bit different because there is a NCC, National Communications Commission, that oversee the electronic media, especially cable news stations. And usually the concern is one of a moral one, and which means less body bag journalism, less sensationalization of news, and also it is independent in a sense that the viewers, if you read newspapers or watching cable news channels, you have a wide range of political spectrum to get. And that means you can get a whole picture probably by looking at all the newspapers and all the television stations across the political spectrum. But if you want to have a one-shop-for-all or one-stop-for-all kind of media, you don't get it. You have to watch or read all of them. And in terms of impact of the media, we finished professionalism, which is left a lot to be desired. And independence, well, it's an independence in a different way. And in terms of impact as a whole, it remained quite influential. And for printed media, even though it does not make a lot of money, but it is still initiate the daily news cycle. And it is setting the issue, setting the agenda, and there's no question about it. And for cable news operators, it is basically doing the follow-up of the news story set by the major newspapers like the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal here. And the cable news does the follow-up or explore more deeply or exploit certain stories that is set by the printed media. And but on the other hand, even though political cable news stations does not have the wherewithal to really to do big and substantial investigative reporting, one advantage is the political talk shows. And political talk shows, they have talking heads being invited to the different channels and talking about political issues of the day. And they're influential in a way that, first of all, it have a strong impact on the powers that be in terms of shaping or changing their policy position. And also, again, it have more or less an impact on tomorrow's edition of the daily newspaper. So cable news is influential also in that way. And also in terms of cable news impact, it has become very, very substantial. It is a unique Taiwan phenomenon. For example, in the United States, people don't watch television news, nor people read newspapers. And in Japan, people read newspapers, like the Yomiuri Shimbun. The daily circulation is about 11 million. And Asahi Shimbun is about maybe 9 million. And for Washington Post and the New York Times, it is about a million circulation a day. And watching cable news television has become a daily routine. And the chances are if you go about strolling around the street and you go to see a mom-and-pop shop, and chances are there's a TV set hanging on top of the ceiling, and the chances are it is tuned to one of the cable news stations. And that's how the saturation of media and the media influence comes from. And is there a way, is there a need to change the way media operate in terms of their professionalism, independence, and impact? Of course, but it's virtually impossible. And long story short, first of all, there is no incentive to change the status quo, because the people who are in the business most likely do not think there's anything wrong with it or there's anything you can do about it. And secondly, in terms of the market situation, is we have an oversaturation of especially cable news channels. And it is the number of cable news channels is unlikely to go down. And we have the next television belongs to the next media group, which is vying for a position in the carrier. For example, what we see here, Comcast or Verizon Vios, they're trying to build up a presence. And also in terms of revenue and market share, because as I have said earlier, the annual budget is about 60 billion NT, 2 billion US, and therefore everybody has only a small piece of the pie. And once you don't make a lot of money, it's difficult for you to reinvest in people, in equipment, so on and so forth. And the perception of media's role over the years is, first of all, the tabloidization, and which was championed and pioneered by the Next Media Group. And it doesn't matter whether you're more of an intellectual and a moderate newspaper like the United Daily News or the China Times, you're influenced by it. And your coverage, to a certain extent, of certain news is influenced by it. And the same thing goes to, for example, Liberty Times. Liberty Times, of course, we know is pro-green. But their coverage sometimes, well, actually, they have quite a strong coverage in terms of tabloid issues. And also, the problem, aside from tabloidization, is the alienation of the upper crust of the society from mass media. And you hear very often that people who are of a higher education or of higher social status or standing, they'll tell you, you know, we don't watch television, or we don't subscribe to cable services, or we only watch CNN or English programmings. And lastly, what the government reform or industry changes may need to be considered? Well, a long story short, given the fundamentals, first of all, the small market size and the oversaturation, which lead to any kind of substantive change, unlikely. And at the same time, because you are vying for such a small piece of pie, so the competition is fierce and cutthroat. And in terms of government initiatives, the government is trying to put quality in the rating system. And they started to initiate a program, but we'll see how it goes, because there's a lot of practical issues to be resolved. And, of course, what the government can do is total deregulation. of the market, for example, cable news, and you have, and which inevitably will lead to a consolidation. And a consolidation means a better resource distribution, but which is, of course, given the political climate in Taiwan, it is not going to happen. And in terms of tighter regulation, you set a ceiling in terms of how many stations or channels are allowed or available in a given segment. For example, home shopping or variety shows or even news. Well, it's not going to happen either. And so in terms of industry, what the industry can do, long story short, of course, self-discipline. And we've seen the effect of that. And internal education, and which is many organizations are doing that with different degrees of intensity and varying degrees of success. And, of course, on-job training. But, again, given the nature of the small market size and the fierce competition and the numbers of participants in the market, again, all the improvements are bound to be limited. And that's about – that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, the next one would be Eric Yu. He's going to talk about public opinion and elections in Taiwan.
Well, I do need the PowerPoint, so – Okay. First of all, it's my great honor to be here and to make the presentation about Taiwan's election. And thank you, Richard, and thank you, Larry. It's always glad to see old friends here and also have such great opportunity to meet new friends. So today I think I will have been assigned the topics that relate to Taiwan's elections and Taiwan's democratic development. So I know that with this audience, people are familiar with Taiwan's politics, and so I won't talk too much details about Taiwan's electoral politics, but I want to talk about one assignment that actually sometimes researchers neglect, which is the perception of the elections. And I do think that's kind of an interesting topic. Then I try to find the data, because I'm a data person, and to try to find the data to see, well, what kind of data that I can show to the audience. Then I did find some data, and I think it's interesting. So I would like to have this opportunity to share some data evidence with you. And I know that Larry probably will talk about the data, Taiwanese perceptions about democracy. Then let Larry talk about that kind of broad issue. And I will just focus on two smaller issues that I will talk about, legislative election and presidential election. So first, I think Taiwan is a kind of election nation, right? So we do have elections 22 times over the past 20 years since 1992. And almost every year we have election almost every year except in 1997, 2003, and 2007. So that gave us a great opportunity because I work for Election Study Center, although I just came back to Taiwan for 3 years. But that gave us a great opportunity to conduct surveys every year. So it's good to have funding to do surveys because we have elections. So so that's also one of the benefits to have election, at least for survey researchers. So so one thing that we want to think about is the impacts of elections. Of course, election is the kind of the essence of democratic development. And then I try to think what kind of, how election can be as, in the academic jargon, can be an independent variable that affect Taiwan's democratic developments. And I noticed that, well, it seems to me that a lot of things are shaped by elections. And I will briefly talk about three major things. One is a party system, and then a political cleavage, and also, well, and government system, because we know that, well, for example, like the elections in the mid-90s, remembering that the Taipei's mayoral election was the first time that we saw the new party split from the KMT. So election, even the local election, mayoral elections make some kind of difference. And in terms of political cleavage, we do notice that the issue that divide different parties and divide different camps, along with the ethnic identity to the national identity. I think Shelley, I always have great insight from Shelley's presentation. And last time when I was at Stanford talking, have a seminar with her, she mentioned that, well, it's kind of the transformation in terms of China factor in Taiwan. So in the 80s, people talk a lot about ethnic identity. That's the China factor inward Taiwan, right? So we have mainlander versus Taiwanese. Then up to 90s, in the late Li Denghui's periods, we start having a national identity problem that is also associated with the China factor, right? Taiwan become a solid nation that face China, and then it's kind of a China factor onward. It's not a kind of inward problem. So we do see the change of political cleavage along with the electoral politics. Then we also experience the divide government under Chen Shui-bian, which actually, as we saw, of the elections. That is, we use the first past the post system for the presidential election. So we do have we did have a minority president, and then we got a chance to experience divide government. So elections really shaped Taiwan's democratic development and gave us a lot of experience about how we can have a stable political system. And again, although we have a lot of elections, but elections are still very important in Taiwan. We still have a relatively high turnout rate, and elections always unpredictable, and in a good way, not in the bad way. Okay. And then we want to see, did the election matter, or will election matter in the future? So I want to give you some insight from a viewpoint of the general public. So I will talk a little bit about Taiwan's public opinions on several key issues by using the Election Study Center data. And then I will talk about the perception about the change of electoral institution. Professor Ye just mentioned about that, and I try to provide another perspective on the change of electoral institution. Then I will talk about the perception of regarding the presidential election. And so I think this is as one of the research fellow from the Election Study Center, so I would like to share this kind of important data, historical data train. And I know that most of you who study Taiwanese politics are not familiar with this data set. This is a partisanship dated back from 1992 up to 2011. So we do observe that the partisanship has been shaped by presidential election. And the green is the DPP line, and the blue is the KMT line. So in the very beginning, before 2000, we do observe the increasing trend of the DPP. And up to 2000, the DPP remained kind of stable, and KMT, of course, some up and down, simply because of those splitters. But I think the bottom line is that 2000 can be regarded as an important benchmark, and since then, if you use the blue line at those small parties, small KMT splitters, you do observe the kind of the gap between the KMT and DPP. That's why people usually called that's the normal votes in Taiwan, in the sense that the KMT has some edge over the over election. And about national identity, this is the question Sherry just talked about, the Taiwanese versus Chinese identity. No doubt about it, there is an increasing trend of the Taiwanese identity. So I don't see that the trend will stop anyway, but that's the fact that since 1992, we do see a lot of people starting to think about themselves as Taiwanese rather than Chinese, or even both, or not even both. Okay, that's a piece of evidence. And the last thing is about the cross-strait relations. And two things we need to, two things that I want to emphasize is there is no market for unification. So both unification lines are kind of decreasing. This is a status quo of the unification with mainland China, unified with mainland China. This is the unify with mainland China as soon as possible. But the bottom line is no market for unification. And we do observe a steadily increasing line, increasing trend of the status quo. So that gave the both parties some kind of two strategy over the past 10 years. That is the sorting mechanism. And from the data, and I think I had a paper about that, is arguing that the KMT used to maintain the status quo to sort the supporters. So, and on the other hand, the DPP used Taiwan identity to sort the supporters. And beforehand, we do see that these two dimensions in national identity and cross-strait relations kind of conflate. But up to now, I do agree with Sherry's observations that they are kind of separate. So Taiwanese voters have different things to think about. And Taiwanese identity might be an emotional feeling. And the cross-strait relations includes, when they think about cross-strait relations, they start to consider some practical issues and economic incentives. So again, it seems to me that that both parties use different dimension to sort their supporters, and that's how we talk. That's what we observe about Taiwan's party competition, especially over the past decades. And then I think there's something that I want to stress is asked by Professor David Brown last time when you visit the Election Study Center. You talk about people like to talk about national identity, cross-strait relations. What's the most important issues in Taiwan's elections? And I dig the data from in the 2008 data. And I do apologize that I'm not able to provide the 2012 data. And that is still in the keying phase, and it will release in two months. And so this time I can only use the data up to 2008. But in 2008, we think that about 12% of the voters think economic development is a key issue. And cross-strait relations, number two, is about 11%. And the third major, the third important issues could be the political stability. And I think I remember that when you came to the Election Study Center, my fellows also argued that economic developments usually the most important issue in the elections. And at least over the past few years, it's indeed the most important issues. So overall, two dimensions shape the party competitions, and people care not only about those two dimensions, but also care about economic development. That's how we think about Taiwan's electoral politics. And next, then I want to turn to the a smaller issue, which is the legislative yuan election. I think Professor Ye mentioned about it, the electoral reform in 2008, so I won't talk about it any. And there's just some issues we want to think about, is whether the new system facilitated a two-party system, because there are more than 60% of the seats determined by the single member districts. And then we can use the some formula to calculate the effective number of parties in legislative yuan dated back to the 1992. And these are under SNTV system, and we do see that the number of effective parties normally more than 2.5. But after the 2008, the effective number of the parties decreased significantly, especially in 2008. And this time, because we have two small parties, two minor parties, so the numbers just increased a little bit more than two. But we want to reconsider whether it will facilitate the two-party system. Later on, I will talk about is it good or bad to Taiwan. And the major difference between the two parties from parties' perspective is that under the SNTV, because it's a multi-member districts, parties get to nominate multiple candidates. So the winning strategy is try to nominate the right number of candidates. But under the current system, with a large proportion of the single-member districts, the party need to nominate the right candidates instead of nominate the right number of candidates. So that actually put the two major parties become the electoral machines. I will also talk a little bit about that. Well, I don't have time to share some of the data. But anyway, these are some data I draw from the TDS. So for example, with the new electoral system, people think it's more difficult to elect the ideal candidates, because with the one-on-one election, you are not able to vote sincerely sometimes. You need to choose the less disliked vote candidates. And also they think that because it's a one-on-one election, so it increase the division of our society. And let me just skip. About vote buying, it seems to me that it decreased a little bit, but not very significant. And compared with the old system, people don't think that people actually don't like to go to vote, because you are not able to choose your ideal candidates. So that makes sense to me. And then we are. It's about quality of the legislative, but this is probably the question addressed our major issue, this democratic development. Some people think that it's actually better for Taiwan, I need further investigation about the reasons, but that's the bottom line. And let me just skip this part. And then I want to briefly talk about the people's perception about the presidential elections. And I tried to, because in 2004 we asked a set of questions, in 2008 we repeat those questions so we can do the comparison. And people do think that the 2008 elections is a better one in terms of promote ethnic harmony, you won't be surprised that in 2008 people don't think the election is about Taiwan independence. But that means the electoral result will have no impact on people's opinion about Taiwan independence. And 2008, more people do think that it improves. The presidential election improved democracy comparing with the 2004. And in 2004, because it's a kind of controversial election, it did cause social instability, and that reflects in public opinion polls. These are post-electoral electoral survey results. And I leave these to okay. So this is an assessment about the quality of election. So at least more than 70% of the people think that the election is fair. So I think This is not 2012. It's supposed to be 2008. Okay. And let me just because I only have 1 minute. Let me just jump to the conclusion. So the bottom line is that did the election indeed reflect public opinion and shape party politics? And the one of the questions that I want to ask is, did the new electoral system have broad impact? And I think Professor Ye addressed the party competition. And but the next question I probably want to ask, but I didn't get the chance to ask in the first panel, is whether the new electoral rule affect the balance between the executive and the legislative power. So think about institutional-wise, instead of a party competition, whether or not the new electoral rule strengthen the role of the legislative yuan in the lawmaking process, or actually decrease its role in the lawmaking process. So I think that's kind of I don't have the answer, so probably I need some experts on legislative yuan to answer that question. And the several slides I jump over is to talk about the performance. And I think in the recent elections, performance matters. The slides I want to show is that even though Ma Ying-jeou got reelected, but over time, his past 4 years, his bad performance indeed has a negative impact on other elections. And people do think about economic development and do think about the government's performance. So it's not only about national identity as people talk about before, but also the performance makes some difference. And then there is a new institution probably I want to mention, is the bundle of elections. So starting from this time, we try to bundle the presidential and legislative UN elections. And 2 years later, we will bundle all the local elections. With these kind of combined elections, national tie could play some significant role. Although I agree with Professor Ye that 11, so like for the legislative UN elections, it starts with 11 versus 0 in the very beginning. But if there is a big national tie in favor of the DPPs, who knows what will happen at the end. So that's the presentation I have, and thank you for any question.
Thank you. We still have about 35 minutes to go before opening up the to the floor. Let me just ask a question. Raise a question about national identity and so on, which both Sherry and Eric Yu, they discussed a lot. And particularly I was intrigued by the term used by Sherry, that is, the Taiwanese party seems don't care that much about meaningful preferences. And I'm not so sure about what meaningful preferences are, but any society, when the parties emerge, mainly because people are different. And for instance, there are workers who want to have high wages and so on. And then there are also the owners of the factories. They want to lower the production costs to lower the wages and so on. And these are diametrically different. And it's hard to say which one is right or wrong. But as a result, of course, we see the parties emerge. One party called the Socialist Party or Labor Party or something, and trying to represent the working class interests, and they also witness some other party like Conservative and so on. They are trying to represent the owners of the factory. And these are just kind of natural in many societies. And then what happened in Taiwan? And because we do see that even though in the elections, sometimes people, as Eric just argued, that sometimes people may vote on the base of performance and so on. But generally speaking, if you look at the two major political camps, all those political parties, the major dividing line remain essentially national identity. People are just different in terms of unification, in terms of independence or status quo and so on. And before coming to the United States, actually I taught in Taiwan for for a number of years. And I remember that at one time one of my students came to see me saying that he's going to graduate. I said, congratulations. And he said that he's going to organize a socialist party in Taiwan. I said, good luck. I don't think you're going to succeed. And if indeed the those political parties are out of sync with the so-called public opinion or whatever, then how come no one else actually try to form some kind of parties to attract the real voters? And my question is very simple. That is, is this kind of a national identity cleavage is not meaningful enough, or will there be some other alternative that we will see in the future? And I'm not so sure about this. I don't know whether Shelly or Eric or anyone else will have the answer.
Well, one answer to the question about third parties, you know, we've seen a lot of information about third parties this morning already, and I think the moral of the story is that there have been multiple attempts to create third parties that have foundered on basically the institutional problems. And that's, you know, under SNTV, there should be room for third parties, but you have this hegemonic KMT coming out of the authoritarian era that has the ability to dominate elections for the first several rounds. And so to be a small party really puts you in the position of kind of the Japanese opponents to the LDP for 50 years. There has always been in this system a strong incentive to try to consolidate everyone against the KMT under a single flag. Yet, nonetheless, in frustration, multiple third parties have emerged to try and kind of affect the direction of the political conversation. And it's in some ways kind of really discouraging that in that kind of environment, what we get is an institutional reform that's designed to consolidate a two-party system, that is single-member district elections, because it makes it that much harder for that kind of third-party or realignment to emerge. In this most recent election, in January, by far the most interesting economic platform was the one articulated by the PFP, which had a really interesting tax policy, really interesting kind of economic reform and kind of business reform. And I think it was because the PFP national campaign was so marginal that they kind of said to this one econ professor, you know, make up a platform. But the platform you made up was really cool. And I thought, you know, if only the PFP could actually get big enough to raise these issues and put these issues into the debate. Unfortunately, the way the system works, it's really hard to do that.
Okay, that's why I just raised the question to see, ask the question about whether we really want to have a two-party system. And indeed, with the current system, we won't be able to find a significant third party. We might end up having some minor parties, just like the result of this election, but we won't have a significant third party at all. But there is one concern. In 2008, I had conducted a survey asking about that kind of social issues. And at the time that the people really think that people don't like to think to be labeled as a socialist, or they do think that the government should not intervene individuals' economic life. But it was the data in 2008 or 2007. It's not even 2009. But recently, I think China factor also makes some kind of contribution in the social inequality issue. I think in those post-electoral forums that I joined in Taiwan, I did mention that Dr. Tsai Ing-wen's campaign also hinged on that issue. That is, well, when we engage more about with mainland China, we do create some have versus have-nots in Taiwan. So China factor may be related with the social inequality issue, and that may change the previous social economic dimensions as a political cleavage in Taiwan. So, but I'm not sure about it. I want to see if how it developed and how it evolved. And maybe it's still about China, right? It's, even though we do think social inequality is an important issue in Taiwan, but combining with the China factor, we might get back to the national identity issue again.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Larry.
I'd like to ask about an issue that was in your slides, Eric, but that you didn't have time to really expand on. Now, you all briefly alluded to it, and that's the question of polarization.
So the questions are the following. Number one, is the political system in Taiwan more polarized politically than it was 4, 8, 12 years ago? Number two, if it is more polarized, obviously it would be between the two political camps, but what's the basis of it? In the U.S., it's become more ideologically coherent in both parties and more militant. Polarization implies poles. So what's the continuum of divergence or opposition? Is it becoming ideological in the more conventional Western sense, which it has become in Korea, by the way, or is it that is left-right, or is it the, you know, national identity or ethnic identity? But then you've suggested, each of you, that in some ways the edges have been softened of division on the cross-strait issue. And if there is growing polarization, I'll tell you, this guy there is responsible for it. That's a joke to say that, to ask Eric about the other part of the dimension here, which is there's a theory about politics in advanced industrial societies, and it's very, very prominent here in the United States, that a major reason for growing political polarization is the loss of a common space of dialogue and information. That is, the fragmentation of the media sector into what are called, both in terms of cable television and the internet, and again with the internet playing apparently a much more important role now in politics in Korea than it plays so far in Taiwan. But whatever it is, you spoke about it very dramatically in your presentation, you've got so many niche markets that everybody's living in an echo chamber of information and opinion. Nobody's really kind of taking on a wider a set of opinions and information and getting a more nuanced view of things. So is there polarization, and is the fragmentation of the media market part of the reason for it?
Should we start with the person who should be responsible for this?
Okay, and about polarization, I always argue that in Taiwan, although Professor Liao might say a different word about it, but I don't think polarization is a major issue in Taiwan. Although I just put it on slide. Maybe politicians polarize, but not among general public. And but recently we do observe some kind of change. And so first of all, I want to mention that the reason why there is no polarization is because two parties emphasize different dimensions. As I just mentioned, that the KMT just try to say, well, they are also Taiwanese. So they try to observe those supporters from that belongs that categorize themselves as Taiwanese, but they focus on the cross-strait relations by arguing that they are the parties that want to maintain the status quo. But the DPPs on the other hand, although they previously, not this election, they try to emphasize that they are the representative of Taiwanese, and which is actually supported by the increasing proportion of voters. But the problem is that the DPP didn't kind of penetrate to the KMTC issue, which is the cross-strait relations. So that's probably that's probably the reason to explain the success of the KMT's campaign in the 2012 election. But the bottom line is that they are compete on two different dimensions, not actually polarized on any single ideological dimension. That's the thing. That's one of the things that I observe. And the voters don't, but politicians try to make some noise via the media, and they try to paint the two groups kind of polarize. And we always need to kind of differentiate division and polarization. So now we only have two choices. So it's divisions kind of are in political divisions are inevitably between the two, because we only have two major parties. But does that necessarily mean the polarization? I kind of suspected about it, especially among voters.
Yeah. Do you want to say it first?
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer. And polarization and differentiation are two different things. Parties have to differentiate themselves. Otherwise, voters won't know what to do. But how do we recognize when differentiation is polarization? But Daphith Fell has written usefully on this topic, making the point that both major political parties in Taiwan are divided between a faction that focuses on winning elections and a faction that focuses on maintaining a kind of ideological purity. And I think this year in the DPP, you saw just full-out warfare between those who said the goal of a platform and strategy is to win the election and those who said if winning the election requires selling out our core ideology, we don't want to win. I mean, I don't know that they actually said we don't want to win, but they talked themselves into believing that they could choose purity over other goals, and they did. And you know, so I think Daphne's argument, although he applied it to elections in the 90s, is still very useful now.
Eric, do you want to say a few words about media?
It is interesting regarding the national identity issue, the political polarization, and also the practicality of the electorate as a whole. And in the past, I firmly believed in that if a society is divided as in Taiwan, there's really no future to speak of unless you have that fundamental question resolved. It is like the Civil War in the United States. If you don't have a Civil War or the ending of that Civil War, you cannot set forth a fundamental path for the nation, and hence the developments and the United States as we know today. In the past, I firmly believed in this struggle between the two, and the status quo or unification, and or push for Taiwan identity and Taiwan independence. And it was, of course, fueled and helped, eating and abetting by the news media, and especially political talk shows, and the newspapers with strong ideological leanings, and also the radio talk shows. These are all very, very important. And we've seen the combination of all of these three during Chen Shui-bian's years in between 2000 and 2008. And But I think, ironically, I think it is also because of President Chen and his policy of division, or his politics of division, that actually made most of the people realize that in 8 years, people realize that the ideology you championed, that is Taiwan identity and especially Taiwan independence, is not going to work. And it only take 8 years to spend, it only take 8 years for people to become disillusioned about the idea that you believed in for your whole life is really remarkable. I mean, usually it takes a generation or two. But in President Chen's case, well, he really pushed it to the brink. And people realize that in 8 years, your policy and what you believe in is not going to work. And that, interestingly, led to the practicality of the electorate. People are still believed in national identity. You have your own views, and I have mine. And people are still polarized because watching a political talk show or reading newspaper editorials or listening to talk radio is like a group therapy. It is essentially like group therapy. You don't listen. If you're pro-blue, you don't listen to the radio talk show on the green station or the political talk show in green television stations, or you just don't read the Liberty Times and vice versa. But
okay, I don't watch Fox News. So.
but I think Taiwan is not big enough to set its own agenda, and it is small enough to feel that the surroundings, and especially the influence of mainland China, and on real terms, in practical terms, have on the daily lives of Taiwanese people or people on Taiwan. And so therefore, even though you have national identity issues remain to be solved, you have polarization that is still in existence, but the 2012 election really manifested the practicality of the electorate. That is, we can set aside those very important issues, but those issues are still very important, but they're not on top of the priority list. They're not on top of the to-do list. And so this is, in a way, it's a legacy, one of the biggest legacies left by President Chen. It took 8 years to destroy a dream. And for people in 8 years to become very, very practical. Thank you.
Yeah, but I think the world civil war is probably too strong. And of course, there has been some kind of hostility between the two camps and so on. But I think Taiwan is still in much better shape than a society like Northern Ireland, for instance. In Northern Ireland, either you are in, at least before the 1998 Group Flight Agreement, and you are either in the United Kingdom or in the Irish Republic. It's hard to find a certain the compromise position. But at least in the case of Taiwan, between the so-called independence and unification, there's something called status quo. So that's probably not the best choice for many people, but that's the second best. I mean, the kind of option they can live with. That's also why, there seems to be some kind of hostility, and when you turn on the TV and so on, but you talk to the people in the streets, you don't really feel that way. And you also don't see casualties in the elections or something. At least Taiwan's election has been very peaceful, very smooth. And I think that's probably, I take a little issue with Eric here. That is it's a kind of a hostile situation somewhat. But generally speaking, I think Taiwanese society is still quite peaceful and smooth and harmony, in some kind of harmonious.
Can I add one evidence about polarization?
And there's one also one thing that I want to share with you is about how both parties solve the intra-party competition, and that's the way to think about whether parties are ideological. And I think both parties now use the polling primary to decide their candidates, the candidate for legislative yuan. And this is a way to delegate your power to the general public to decide who to decide your candidates. So both parties tend to become political electoral machines. So in that case, how could you expect that the party try to maintain its ideology? Keeping in mind that polling primary usually takes place in those party strength districts because multiple candidates want to compete within the party because once he or she can win the nomination, he is kind of guaranteed to win the general election. So, but even in that kind of case, party try to use the polling primary to, number one, to try to find someone who is really electable. Second, to resolve the intra-party conflict. So you can, if a party is willing, if both parties are willing to delegate their own power to the general public to decide their candidate. So I don't think that the parties are kind of ideological driven. They are mainly focused on winning the election rather than to elaborate its own ideology.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Yes.
Hi, Nadia Chow with the Liberty Times. I just have a question for Shirley. You just mentioned you got a study on Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. And we know that Taiwan's democracy, China, is a given factor. Like, you know, constitutional reform is restrained by China factor. But could you tell us, you know, when you do the comparison, what's the common ground or similar question that Korea and Japan and Taiwan face? Because they're just different, you know, environment. But we also see the similarity that no system or politician or party can satisfy their voters. And they seem to face the, you know, similar problems. So could you give just a very simple analysis? Thank you.
The question takes us a little afield from the day, so I'll try to be brief. One thing that I think is very interesting that unifies those cases is the idea of being an abnormal country, which doesn't sound very nice, but is actually a kind of discourse that's used in the region, that Japan is an abnormal country because it doesn't have a military, it doesn't take responsibility for its own fate in the way that countries typically do. Korea is an abnormal country because it's divided. And Taiwan is an abnormal country because it is either divided or it is still in an ambiguous relationship that makes it impossible to resolve itself. So I think that in each of these countries, there's a kind of transcendent debate that hangs over all other issues. And I was really interested in how Eric, I copied down one of his slides that said that behind the economic issues, we see China's role. And I think behind a lot of issues in Korea, we see the problem of unification. And the problem of unification, which often manifests itself in a debate actually about Korea's relationship with the U.S., not with North Korea. And in Japan, behind a lot of issues is the problem of are our economic troubles somehow prompted by or created by our failure to be a normal country, right? Someone like Kobayashi Yoshinori, the manga artist who also writes about Taiwan, he wants to say all of our problems can be traced to our masochistic outlook toward history. So, you know, I think in all of these places you have some really interesting issues that kind of overhang the standard kind of economic policy stuff. And then the other big similarity that I have fun with my students is electoral reform and party building. And what we see is that all three countries do kind of similar electoral reforms in approximately similar time frame with very similar objectives, which I would argue in all three cases are slowly materializing. So that as a political scientist, you know, some of us speculated about what would be the kind of output changes associated with particular institutional reforms, and we're actually being proved mostly kind of right, at least in terms of all three countries settling into two-party systems that are more and more focused on economic issues, but with these weird overhangs. So those are the things that I see.
Yeah, thank you. I thought I know the answer. Yes.
Hi, Garrett Van Wees of Taiwan Communique again. I had a question for Eric. You talked about the increase of the status quo. About a year ago, TVBS had a poll which showed that answer to the question, if you have a choice, what is your preference? And then the support for independence is like 68%. So isn't the status quo really an artificial construct shaped by the Chinese cloud that Shelley was talking about? I also had a question for Eric Xi. In your whole presentation about news media in Taiwan, you did not discuss the increasing Chinese influence on news media. There has been a lot of talk about that, the embedded advertisements, the ownership of news organizations like your own and like Want by parties directly or indirectly controlled by China. A lot of additional news broadcast on the radio AM frequencies from China over the past year. So what is your view on the encroaching influence of China on media in Taiwan?
Okay, Eric, first.
By the way, are you talking about those conditional questions asking if, for example, Taiwan could be an independent country if China won't attack Taiwan?
The question was, if you have a choice, right. What is your preference, independence, unification?
Yeah, that's the... I do agree with you that if people have preference under certain conditions, and you do observe a lot of people will support Taiwan independence, that's for sure. And those questionnaires are also included in multiple academic research. But the problem is that in those questionnaires, we always kind of give that condition as a certain environment. But in fact, those conditions are not certain environment, right? So that's why people try to put themselves in a safe way by arguing maintaining the status quo, because number one, they are kind of ambiguous about the two different values. Well, should I pursue the economic interest in China, or should I maintain my soul in the sense that to maintain myself as a Taiwanese? So they are kind of ambiguous between the two different values, and they are uncertain about certain information. For example, if Taiwan claims independence, does China guarantee attacking Taiwan? Maybe not, right? But although they try to, China's always tried to make such argument. But there are a lot of ambiguousness and uncertainties among in the cross-strait relations. So when you have the questionnaires that fix conditions, well, people are easy to answer those kind of questions and are willing to express their deep feelings. But that's not the ideal words at all. That's only the ideal word. The real word is that people are ambiguous about the different values and uncertain about the different uncertain about the information, and that's why people try to settle as a status quo.
Well, I think the 68% question is both real and is moot. The reason is very simple, because we live in a real world, and that is a question that is not based in a real world or real circumstances. Or, for example, if you ask the Polish people back in the 1920s, do you want to eliminate the Soviet Union? Yeah, 90% would say yes. Do you want to eliminate Germany, Weimar Republic? 95% would say yes. And if you ask the British back in the late 1980s or early 1990s, do you want Germany to remain divided? Well, 95% would say yes. And but it doesn't matter. It's a moot question because we live in a real world, and you have to consider the course of action and the choice you make, and as the result of what we see today, Taiwan being what Taiwan is. And secondly, with regarding to the increase of Chinese influence, and first of all, I have to say these are my personal views, and it is in no way represent the organization that I work for. This is a disclaimer. And but I think it is fair to say that the influence by mainland China is proportionate by and large to its standing in the world. And I remember when I was a reporter back here in Washington in the mid-1990s, if you read the day book by Reuters or by the Federal News Service, you hardly see a word about China. And then, remarkably and unbelievably, the word China start popping up. And nowadays, we're not talking about China as if whether it will become a great power. It has already become a great power. You're not talking about should we engage China or should we contain China. We have to engage China, and it's just a matter of how we deal with it. And Washington is one of the perfect example because this is the center of the world, and it reflects the power distribution of the rest of the world. And if China becomes a big issue in Washington, then it is a big issue in the rest of the world. And in that case, I think it is only fair to say that China's influence on Taiwan in the news media is proportionate to China's influence on any other society, be it in Pakistan, be it in South Korea, or be it in Japan, or be it in the United States. And it's, you just look at it differently, but the influence as the People's Republic grow stronger and bigger, it will become a part of your calculus. And it is very simple, and it has nothing to do with whether you like it or whether you don't like it. It's just a fact that is there that you have to be aware of and that you have to deal with.
Okay, we have only about 2 minutes left, so let's have a very brief question and a very brief answer. Okay.
Thank you. My name is Jin Ling Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. And thank you, Mr. Xi, and you for your very candid answer, personal view. And let's be real. So my question is the status quo that Taiwan has tried to maintain. From everything that you just presented, is that real? Can it ever be real to stay status quo? And for that, the democratization of Taiwan, can it ever be true? So back to the fact that you admit that China is there in Taiwan and everywhere in the part of the world. So the recent election, the result was already decided for Ma to win before we even have an election. So then come back to the global situation, especially with Dr. Rieger and her book that about Taiwan's small island but global power. How would Taiwan see itself in the context of the Southeast Asian Sea? Because Taiwan plays a key role in that. So with that, would you ever be status quo if China wanted to take over Taiwan just because of that position in the South China Sea?
Okay, thank you. Very brief 30 seconds for... This is direct to Eric, right? Eric, yeah.
I'll try to give you a very, very, very brief answer. The status quo in Taiwan is a slowly evolving proposition. And such can be compared to the socioeconomic transformation of mainland China. And honestly speaking, we don't know what China's going to be in terms of economic development aside, in terms of political system and how it's going to evolve and the one-party rule. We just don't know. And both sides are evolving. And so the outcome of the interaction of the two is very, very difficult to judge. And you can claim that China is getting bigger by the day, and so it wishes to use force to resolve the Taiwan issue, then yes, China can. But you can also argue that China does not have the wherewithal to initiate a military strike to resolve the Taiwan issue without breaking down its own society first. And so you also have a different proposition that is gaining in popularity, that Taiwan's democracy, Taiwan's path to democracy and development has become a role model for the Chinese society as a whole. And one is getting more optimistic that given the stable environment that China needs for itself to grow, Taiwan would become more and more influential, not in terms of how powerful military it is or how powerful economically it is, but what Taiwanese society of Chinese roots that adopt a democratic electoral system that actually works can go a long way of impacting the future of domestic politics on the mainland. And so it's on both sides, it's gradually evolving. So it's really, really difficult, if impossible, to make a judgment and saying that, well, this will be the end of it or that will be the end of it. We just don't know.
Okay, thank you. Because the time's up, so we have a stop. And let's thank the speakers for their excellent presentations.